Chapter 5. Well, don't worry about it. It was an uneventful morning at the Army's Opana radar station near Kahuku Point, on the northern tip of Oahu. Normally, Privates Joseph Lockard and George Elliott made 25 plane contacts during the regular 4 to 7 a.m. watch, but this Sunday there was hardly anything. The Opana station was one of 5 mobile units set up at strategic points around the perimeter of Oahu. They were all linked to an information center at Fort Shafter, which kept track of the plots picked up by the stations. The system could pick up any plane within 150 miles, when it worked. But it had just started operating around Thanksgiving and was still full of bugs. Lockard, Elliott, and the others spent most of their time training and making repairs. At first they practiced from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m., but after Washington's warning of November 27th, they went on duty every morning from 4 to 7. General Short felt these were the critical hours. Then they trained until 11 and knocked off for the day. On Sundays, they worked only the 4 to 7 shift. To the men, this was simply a change in hours, not a change in routine or approach. It was all very casual at Opana. This was the most remote of the 5 stations, and the 6 men who ran it were left pretty much to themselves. They had a small camp at Kawaiola, 9 miles down the coast, and commuted to work by pickup truck. They were meant to work in 3-man shifts, but this Sunday they decided that a 2-man shift would do. Lockard served as operator, Elliott as both plotter and motorman. The regular motorman stayed in the sack. They went on duty at noon, December 6th. They had the double job of guarding the set with a 45 pistol and 7 rounds of ammunition and running it during the 4 to 7 watch the following morning. That night they set the alarm for 3:45 a.m., tuned in the set on schedule at 4, and spent the next 3 hours waiting for something to happen. There was a flicker or so around 6:45. Apparently a couple of planes were coming in from the northeast about 130 miles away, but nothing more than that. They weren't surprised when the Shafter Information Center phoned at 6:54 and told them they could start closing up. At the Information Center, Lieutenant Kermit Tyler, the only officer on duty, was having an equally quiet time. Usually the place was quite busy as the 5 stations phoned in their contacts and the spotters moved little arrows around the big wooden plotting table. It was all make-believe, for the other services hadn't yet assigned liaison officers to help screen out friendly planes, but still it made for lively practice. The control officer would plan the interception of the enemy. His assistant, the pursuit officer, would relay his orders to mythical squadrons of army fighters. Sometimes they even practiced with real planes. But this Sunday there was little action. Few contacts, nobody to evaluate the planes that were spotted, no control officer to direct any interception. Except for the enlisted men at the plotting table, only the pursuit officer, Lieutenant Tyler, was on hand. But with nobody to give him orders and no planes to relay orders to, he had nothing to do. Nor did he really know what he was meant to do. He had only drawn this duty once before. Actually, he was there purely for training. Major Kenneth Bergquist, in charge of the radar network, wanted the young pilots to learn as much about the system as possible so they could use it more effectively in interception work. Since the center had to operate from 4 to 7 anyhow, this was a good chance to brush up. Today was Tyler's turn, and it was enough if he kept his eyes peeled. For the first 2 hours, nothing happened. Around 6:10, one of the stations finally phoned in a contact, and the spotters began shoving their arrows around the board. At 6:45, some plots began to show up at 130 miles north of Oahu, not much, but enough to make Lieutenant Tyler wander over and see how the clerk would mark them on the daily record. They showed up as little hen scratches pointing toward Oahu. Then, suddenly it was 7 a.m. and everyone went off to breakfast. Tyler was left alone in the room. For one of those reasons known only to the Army, his orders ran from 4 to 8, an hour beyond everybody else's. He settled back alone, no one to obey, no one to command, and now no one even to talk to. The 7 a.m. closing time made little difference to Privates Lockard and Elliott at Opana. They were at the mercy of the breakfast truck. It usually came about 7, but a man couldn't set his watch by it. With this in mind, they decided to keep the set running until the truck came. Elliott wanted to practice operating the set. After 2 weeks in the outfit, he could do the plotting pretty well, but still was no operator. Lockard was willing to teach him. At 7:02, Elliott sat down and began fiddling with the controls. Lockard leaned over his shoulder and started explaining the various echoes or blips. Suddenly, a blip flashed on the screen far bigger than anything Lockard had ever seen before. It was almost as big as the main pulse the unit always sent out. So big, he thought the set was broken. that somehow the main pulse and mileage scale had gotten out of kilter. It was a pinball machine gone haywire. He shoved Elliot aside and took over the controls himself. Quickly he saw there was nothing wrong with the set. It was just a huge flight of planes. By now Elliot was at the plotting table, and in a few seconds they nailed down the position. 137 miles to the north, 3 degrees east. At 7:06, Elliot tried the headphones that connected directly with one of the spotters in the information center. The line was dead. Then he tried the regular army circuit. After the clicks and hums and wheezes that are the overture to any phone call in Hawaii, he finally got through to the information center switchboard operator, Private Joseph McDonald. McDonald worked in a small cubicle just outside the plotting room and remained on duty even though the center was now closed. Breathlessly, Elliot broke the news. "There's a large number of planes coming in from the north, 3 degrees east." McDonald thought there was nobody left at the information center, so he wrote down the message and turned around to time it by the big clock on the plotting room wall. Through the open door, he suddenly noticed Lieutenant Tyler, sitting alone at the plotting table. There was someone in the building after all. McDonald took the message to the lieutenant. Helpfully, he explained that it was the first time he had ever received anything like this. "Do you think we ought to do something about it?" He suggested they call the plotters back from breakfast. They didn't get too much practice, and this certainly seemed an awful big flight. Tyler was unimpressed. McDonald returned to the switchboard and called back Opana. This time he got Lockard, who was excited too. The blips looked bigger than ever. The distance was shrinking fast. 7:08 a.m., 113 miles. 7:15 a.m., 92 miles. At least 50 planes must be soaring toward Oahu at almost 180 miles per hour. "Hey, Mac," he protested when McDonald told him the lieutenant said everything was all right. Then Lockard asked to speak directly to Tyler, explaining he had never seen so many planes, so many flashes on his screen. McDonald traipsed back to Tyler. "Sir, I would appreciate it very much if you would answer the phone." Tyler took over, listened patiently, and thought a minute. He remembered the carriers were out. These might be Navy planes. He recalled hearing the radio on his way to work, remembered that it stayed on all night whenever B-17s came in from the coast. These might be Flying Fortresses. In either case, the planes were friendly. Cutting short any further discussion, he told Lockard, "Well, don't worry about it." Lockard was now in no mood to keep on. He thought they might as well shut down the set. But Elliot wanted to practice some more, so they followed the flight on in. 7:25 a.m., 62 miles. 7:30 a.m., 47 miles. 7:39 a.m., 22 miles. At this point, they lost it in the dead zone caused by the hills around them. Conveniently, the pickup truck arrived just then to take them back to Kawaiola for breakfast. They slammed shut the doors of the mobile unit, turned the lock, hopped in the truck, and bounced off down the road at 7:45. At the Shafter Information Center, Private McDonald was still uneasy. He asked Lieutenant Tyler what he really thought of the blips and was glad to hear the lieutenant say, "It's nothing." Shortly after 7:30, another operator took over the switchboard, and as McDonald left the building, he suddenly stuck the original Opana message in his pocket. He had never done anything like this before, but he wanted to show it to the fellows. Alone again in the plotting room, Lieutenant Tyler settled back to wait out the last dragging minutes of his own tour of duty. He had no qualms about the Opana message, and although he didn't know it, on one count at least, he was absolutely right. The all-night radio did mean some B-17s were coming in from the mainland. At this very moment, 12 of the big bombers were approaching from the northeast. But the planes that showed upon the Opana screen were a little less to the east, far more numerous, and at this moment, infinitely closer. Commander Mitsuo Fuchida knew they must be nearly there. They had been in the air now almost an hour and a half. But a carpet of thick white clouds stretched endlessly below, and he couldn't even see the ocean to check the wind drift. He flicked on the radio direction finder and picked up an early morning program from Honolulu. By twisting his antenna, he got a good bearing on the station and discovered he was 5 degrees off course. He made the correction, and the other planes followed suit. They were all around him. Behind were the other 48 horizontal bombers. To the left and slightly above were Lieutenant Commander Kakuichi Takahashi's 51 dive bombers. To the right and a little below were Lieutenant Commander Shigeharu Murata's 40 torpedo planes. Far above, Lieutenant Commander Shigeru Itaya's 43 fighters provided cover. The bombers flew at 9,000 feet, the fighters as high as 15,000. All of them basked in the bright morning sun that now blazed off to the left. But below, the clouds were still everywhere. Fuchida began to worry. Would it be as bad over Pearl Harbor? If so, what would that do to the bombing? He wished the reconnaissance planes would report. They should be there by now. And then through the radio music, he suddenly heard a weather broadcast. He tuned closer and caught it clearly. Partly cloudy, mostly over the mountains. Ceiling 3,500 feet, visibility good. Now he knew he could count on the clouds to break once he reached Oahu. Also that it would be better to come in from the west and southwest. Those clouds over the mountains made an eastern approach too dangerous. Then, as if to cap this run of good luck, the clouds below him parted, and almost directly ahead he saw a white line of surf breaking against a rugged green shore. It was Kahuku Point, Oahu. Lieutenant Toshio Hashimoto, piloting one of Fuchida's bombers, was simply charmed. The lush green of the island, the clear blue water, the colored roofs of the little houses seemed in another world. It was the kind of scene one likes to preserve. He pulled out his camera and snapped some pictures. For fighter pilot Yoshio Shiga, this warm, sunlit land had a deeper meaning. Back in 1934, he had been to Honolulu on a naval training cruise, a visit full of good times and pleasant memories. To see Oahu again, still so green and lovely, gave him a strange, nostalgic feeling. He thought about it for a moment, then turned back to the business at hand. The time had come to deploy for the attack, and Commander Fuchida had a difficult decision to make. The plan provided for either surprise or surprise-lost conditions. If surprise, the torpedo planes were to go in first, then the horizontal bombers, finally the dive bombers, while the fighters remained above for protection. The idea was to drop as many torpedoes as possible before the smoke from the dive bombing ruined the targets. On the other hand, if the raiders had been detected and it was surprise lost, the dive bombers and fighters would hit the airfields and anti-aircraft defenses first. Then the torpedo planes would come in when resistance was crushed. To tell the planes which deployment to take, Commander Fuchida was to fire his signal gun once for surprise, twice for surprise lost. Trouble was, Commander Fuchida didn't know whether the Americans had caught on or not. The reconnaissance planes were meant to tell him, but they hadn't reported yet. It was now 7:40 a.m., and he couldn't wait any longer. They were already well down the west coast and about opposite Haleiwa. Playing a hunch, he decided he could carry off the surprise. He held out his signal pistol and fired one Black Dragon. The dive bombers began circling upward to 12,000 feet. The horizontal bombers spiraled down to 3,500. The torpedo planes dropped until they barely skimmed the sea, ready for the honor of leading the assault. As the planes orbited into position, Fuchida noticed that the fighters weren't responding at all. He decided that they must have missed his signal, so he reached out and fired another Black Dragon. The fighters saw it this time, but so did the dive bombers. They decided it was the second Black Dragon of the surprise lost signal. Hence, they would be the ones to go in first. In a welter of confusion, the High Command's plan for carefully integrated phases vanished. Dive bombers and torpedo planes eagerly prepared to slam into Pearl Harbor at the same time. They could already see it on their left. Lieutenant Shiga was attracted by the unusual color gray of the warships. Commander Itaya was struck by the way the battleships were strung out and anchored two ships side by side in an orderly manner. Commander Fuchida was more interested in counting them. 2, 4, 8. No doubt about it, they were all there.